You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 59, Self-Imposed Zombiness. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Patrick Stewart carrying the Olympic torch, the Star Trek Las Vegas event schedule, Star Trek night at Dodger Stadium, and Greg recounts his night at the TNG theatrical event. Then in the feature, we're joined by David Taylor and Drew Stewart to discuss the classic TOS episode, Return of the Archons, and the IDW reimagining. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I'm doing pretty good, having another running around everywhere weekend. And today I've actually had two breakfasts so far. So I'm thinking I must be a hobbit at this point. I'm still waiting for my 11Cs, though.
Hobbits have two breakfasts, I suppose.
Yeah, they have breakfast, and then second breakfast, and then 11Cs, and then lunch, and then brunch, and then there's, like, tea. I forget. They have, like, 8 or 9 meals over the course of the day.
I see. I had forgotten that.
But I had two breakfasts today, and I got sunburned during the second one because, again, this giant yellow orb continues to be hovering above Seattle. I'm thinking it's the light probe, and it's come back, wondering where all the light is. That's boiling the oceans.
Boiling the earth, yes. And
yes. So I'm looking into going back in time and finding the light and bringing it forth. Anywho, Chris, how are you doing this weekend?
Oh, it's been quite a weekend for me as well. Very busy weekend, but it's nice to sit down finally and talk about some Star Trek news. And but one thing I wanted to talk about, Greg, was what you did at the beginning of last week, right after we recorded last week's show, which was the big TNG theatrical event. So tell us, what was it like?
Yes.
Now, you sent me lots of iMessages along the way, and you even sent me a video, a greeting, so it was nice.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I had everybody at the table. So I was there with Sci-Fi Commons and SMXG and Amy Herndon and trying to think of all the other people who... Oh, Clay. Clay was there. ClayStation X from Twitter and quite a few other people. And yes, we were all sat down for dinner. I had several margaritas, actually. I had several frozen margaritas because I knew what was coming up. And what was coming up was where no one has gone before, and especially Datalore. Datalore. Goodness. Well, yes, it was very large. It was very big. You know, early on, they used those crazy wide-angle lenses and got really in the actors' faces. So, you know, you've never seen Patrick Stewart's nose quite as big until you've seen it projected onto a theater screen.
I bet. Well, how did it look overall, though, on the big screen?
It actually looked really good. The special effects, I'm really loving what they've done with the next gen set, the Blu-ray set. And so seeing them on the big screen projected was really nice. There's little subtle things, it's not so much subtle, but in Datalore, the crystalline entity, if you didn't know that they redid it, you'd probably just figure that's the effect from 1987. But it's just slightly better because they redid what was originally a CG effect. So there's little bits with the light being refracted through itself. And but it doesn't look showy. It just looks like it belongs. And, you know, just little bits here and there. And it just all adds up to, it feels like you're watching, you know, not something of movie quality, but something that, It's just so different from like turning on the standard def version that I've been watching for years and years. The colors are correct. You can see actors' faces even when they're, you know, just at the back of the bridge.
Yeah, I was watching. So my TNG season 1 Blu-ray set arrived on Friday, and on Friday night I had my first opportunity to watch something other than what was on the next level sampler disc, and I watched The Naked Now. And talking about, you know, being able to see people's faces much more clearly and all, Wesley is like maniacal. When he's
really,
he's using this gigantic circuit board tractor beam thing that he built to move a chair across the room. And then later he's using the same thing in engineering and his eyes are going crazy and his mouth's going crazy.
Oh, wow.
And I think I tweeted, like, if he were sitting across from me on the train, I would change cars because I would be really concerned about what this person might be about to do.
Wow.
And I never had that feeling before, you know, watching that episode.
Right. Yeah, you definitely get those details from the actors. I don't know if that was quite intended. Wesley comes across a little crazy in The Naked Now. And there's a lot of Brent Spiner's performance that I'm getting out of the Blu-ray. Just very subtle things he does. Even when he's not front and center on the screen, he's always doing something interesting while he's sitting there at the helm. So I've been being able to watch him quite a bit.
So how many people at the theater were dressed in Starfleet uniforms or any other type of alien garb?
Yeah, sadly, it wasn't too terribly Starfleet uniform-y. There were maybe three or four people, honestly, in uniforms. And David got a good picture. That's Sci-Fi Commons. Got a good picture with a couple, you know, Starfleet babes who are wearing the dress uniform from the original series. But it was mostly just normal folks out there to see Star Trek. The thing is, I mean, the theater was packed. It was crazy, actually, how many people were there. It wasn't quite like the Wrath of Khan screening that was a gigantic theater and just full to the brim of people. But this was a mid-sized theater and every ticket was sold out and people were really into it. What I wasn't quite expecting was the reaction from people. I know they can't all have been Dork Trek listeners, but they were finding a lot of the same things amusing that Dork Trek listeners would have found amusing as well.
I can only imagine, yes, in a show like A Data Lore, at least that that's the case.
Yeah. There were a few things, especially when they're taking Data apart and talking about how he's fully functional, and or they're trying to put Lore together, and yes, all of those things.
And then Yar comes in, and I wonder if Lore's fully functional. You're Jim. Or now, as I was watching The Naked Now, I think the best line in The Naked Now is towards the end when Data comes on the bridge and Picard says, "Oh, Mr. Data, at least you're functional." And Data says, "Fully."
Yes. Yeah, I never had noticed that look on Brent Spiner's face before, but the Blu-ray really brought it out.
The look on Spiner's face. Yeah. Spiner is just great in that episode. I can't wait.
How far into the TNG Blu-ray set are you?
That's the only one I've been able to watch because now I've been gone all weekend. Okay. So, but I'm going to be going through them in order. Right now, I've got my parachute pants out. I'm ready for some Hammer Time with Code of Honor.
Yeah, I watched Code of Honor. I watched Last Outpost, and I watched Justice, which the sex planet has never been quite so pristine, and it's a little scary actually. Some of those scenes,
they're
a little too crisp.
Well, I think you sent me an iMessage, and you said that the Edo live in a totalitarian society, but I did correct you. They live in a totalitarian society.
Yes, exactly. But we need to talk about Justice. Maybe that'll be one of our TNG features we do soon, because they murder people for breaking any rule.
Right.
And they keep the peace by keeping everyone in a constant state of fear. Like, that's not good.
You stepped on a flower. It's death for you. Exactly. God, heaven forbid you give somebody incorrect change or something. Wow.
Right.
All right. Well, that was the TNG theatrical night. So it sounds like you had a great time. I wish I could have been there.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully they'll do those for each season. Although, I don't know. I kind of think maybe it was just a one-time thing for the first season. But
yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, because the second season discs are coming out, you know, in just a few months. So I can't imagine they're going to do all of this all over again. But I'd love to see Q Who on the big screen. That would be really fantastic, especially after seeing the preview of it at the event. It's like, wow, that looks really cool. Like they really stepped up the production for season two. I'd love to see 10 forward and all of that. So I don't really quite see it happening.
Yeah, probably not. It seems like it would be a big undertaking, yeah, to keep doing it each time. So anyway, but we'll get the Blu-ray so we can watch it at home, and it's going to be exciting. And hopefully this price drop that we saw in season one is going to become the standard price. You know, if they can price these things at $59.99 per season, then I'll pick them up, and you know, I think most fans will pick them up too. So
yeah, definitely. It's not that crazy expensive. I guess I end up spending, I think, $69.99 because I just went to the local Target. I'll probably pre-order the next one because it seems like Amazon's the place to go at this point.
I think
so. For the lowest price.
Speaking of you paying $69.99, I, for the listeners to know, I got a live purchase session on iMessage in which Greg sent me photos of him taking it off the shelf, putting it on the belt at the register, then it moving down the belt, then it being scanned, then it going into the bag. So, and it was hashtag live purchase. But that was, again, not Twitter. It was iMessage. Yes, Greg and I use hashtags on iMessage.
Just from time for special occasions.
Special occasions, that's right.
I felt it needed to be, you know, documented, but I didn't really want to subject all of my 450 Twitter followers to, here's a picture of the Blu-ray in the bag as I'm walking home.
Here I'm unwrapping it, which actually was a photo I received. So,
yes.
All right. Well, let's move on, Greg. We have a new iTunes review. And last week, we asked everyone who is outside the United States to please give us a heads up if they leave a review in their country's store. And I just got a message this morning from Tanya, who left us a review in the Russian iTunes store.
Oh, kapla.
Kapla, right.
That's all the Russian I know.
So Tanya writes, join these captains in the ready room. And she gives us 5 stars. And she says, whether you're listening to a lot of Trek podcasts or, like me, only introducing yourself to their diversity or perhaps just getting to know the marvelous universe of Star Trek, these guys are the best choice. Not only do they give insight on Trek, but you can also find other sci-fi references in the Ready Room, plenty of humor, and as many interesting and talented guests invited to their weekly shows. Chris and Greg are hilarious, charming, dedicated, and the work they do to provide Trekkies with the latest Trek news and vivacious discussions is indeed brilliant. Sound quality of the Ready Room is amazing, and you have a new episode every week, always on time, full of jokes, curious facts, and entertaining content. The Ready Room is now in my iPod every week, and I always look forward to a new episode. Guys, you're terrific. Keep up the good work. And it's so wonderful how Trek is capable of bringing people of all countries, cultures, and views together to enjoy our geekery.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Tanya.
Yeah, it's great. It's our first review from Russia. And like she said, it's great. I mean, our Twitter group, you know, everyone that we talk to throughout the week on Twitter, it's amazing how diverse everyone is, how many countries we're all located in, and how, of course, Twitter as a technology is able to bring us together. But Star Trek as a show and as a way of looking at the world has brought us together. So it's really wonderful.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's really wonderful the sort of reach that Star Trek has. There are a lot of people overseas who really want to come to the Star Trek theater screening as well and be with us, and that was really exciting. And I wish they'd done theatrical screenings all over the world because the demand is really there. People really, you know, it's not just America that cares about it.
Yeah. Well, they got Australia and Canada, but yeah, it would have been nice if it had been everywhere. But so thank you, Tanya. Spasibo bolshoye. And we're glad that you're listening to us now. All right. So, Greg, Tanya's really enjoying the Ready Room, but apparently not everyone is enjoying the Ready Room. we got an interesting comment from Douglas E. Graves. This is basically, it's our mailbag, but it was actually posted as a comment on the show page. Mm. And Douglas is very unhappy about a comment that Brian made last week, which I'm a little surprised. I'm assuming Douglas doesn't listen to us regularly, or he probably would have taken it a little bit differently. But
yeah.
As we were joking about Faith of the Heart, which is a popular pastime amongst Star Trek fans, I believe that Brian referred to people who like Faith of the Heart as retards. And
I think so.
Now, I agree that, yeah, it's not a good word to use. But I thought everyone can understand that we're just joking about the song. We don't actually think that anyone is a retard. And I would also say that, Greg, you and I are both on record as liking Faith of the Heart. I actually like Faith of the Heart very much as the Enterprise theme song. So that would make me a retard as well.
I mean, it's a difficult thing about podcasts. It's often easy to hear one comment and think that that's the opinion of the podcast.
Right.
But it's important to keep in mind that Trekkies have different opinions. And often we have different opinions from people who are on the show. Sometimes you and I, Chris, actually have differing opinions. the Royale. But I think on Faith of the Heart, you and I are actually... We're together on that it's, I love it. I love the song. I love the opening credits of Enterprise.
Not only are we on record as liking Faith of the Heart, we're also on record as liking Enterprise. And in fact, what did we do? The very first episode of the Ready Room we ever recorded was an Enterprise episode.
Yeah.
So, but this is what Douglas writes. He writes, really, we have to refer to peeps that like Faith of the Heart as retards. That's so not grasping itic and the whole philosophy of tolerance that Star Trek is at its core. No, it's just an action adventure show to most nowadays who miss the whole point of Gene's message in lieu of, if you aren't like me, you're a retard. Sad, really. Sad for those that hold that literally retarded egoic point of view, that is. Okay, so here's what I have to say. So first of all, Douglas, I apologize on behalf of Brian and Greg and Michael and the show, if we offended you. What I would say, though, about itic is that if you want to embrace itic, you have to embrace the fact that not everyone agrees, and some people are going to have strong feelings that are the opposite of yours.
And that's what we try to encourage that. I mean, we could just not have Brian on any Enterprise episodes. But I like having his input. I like hearing his opinion of him, even though he's probably not going to like the given Enterprise episode that we're doing. But because, I mean, we do like diversity. We want to have people on with differing viewpoints. And if it was just us gushing about how amazing it was every week, it wouldn't be quite as interesting. And it wouldn't showcase the actual diversity that exists among Star Trek fans.
Exactly. So again, our apologies if we offended anyone. That was all part of us joking about the song, which we joke quite often on the Ready Room. We're also quite serious. and I think anyone who listens
mostly
to
serious.
Us on a regular basis knows that we don't view Star Trek as just an action adventure show. If we did, we wouldn't have a podcast every week because it'd be pretty boring just to talk about the ships flying around or the phasers being shot all the time. So we certainly do grasp and embrace itic, and that's why we have differing viewpoints on the show. But thanks for listening. We appreciate it, and we hope you'll continue listening and find that we are a lot more diverse than you may think from that.
Yes. So.
All right, Greg, let's move into some other things today. Olympics are going on, and there was a story out and some video out of Sir Patrick Stewart carrying the Olympic torch.
Yeah, I saw that. I'm in my little bubble here in the Kent studio. I haven't seen any of the Olympics, but the one thing I have seen is that picture of Sir Patrick Stewart with the Olympic torch. I don't know how long he carried it, but it's nice to see Star Trek fan or Star Trek given, you know, this attention. I understand people wanted to see Doctor Who references in the opening ceremonies, and they were sadly disappointed. But at least we have this. I understand Benedict Cumberbatch was involved in the torch lighting or something as well.
I believe he was, although his exact activities during the process of carrying the torch are secret.
Oh, of course, yes.
JJ does not want that information getting off the reservation, so...
Right, right. And if you might have heard Carl Urban saying anything about Benedict Cumberbatch holding the torch or perhaps lighting the torch or winning, you know, the women's triathlon, he just got off a 22-hour flight, you have to understand. So any of those remarks were just off the reservation and yes, anyway. Patrick Stewart, though, he seems quite excited. He's a British man at heart, and I imagine he's going to be there in London for the duration of the Olympics.
Yeah, he said he has his chair ready and he's planning to watch a lot of the Olympics. And now I didn't understand if that meant he had a seat kind of reserved in the various venues or a chair in front of the television at home, but which is what I thought.
I imagine he and Data from All Good, future Data from All Good Things, sitting back in their posh chairs and their pipes, and, oh, did you see that biathlete? That's what I'm imagining.
And then he takes a sip of his tea and he goes, you say this is Earl Grey? I could swear it's Darjeeling.
Exactly.
But I think they missed a big opportunity here, though, because I think Patrick Stewart should have been the last person to carry the torch. So he could go up the stairs, he could light the big torch and say, make it so. That's what I would have done.
That would have been,
yeah,
that would have been the best way.
Right.
Olympics, engage.
But these are the same organizers who, at the soccer game the other day involving North Korea, they put the South Korean flag up. So,
right.
I think they missed a couple of opportunities and then fouled up a few details there. But anyway, the Olympics are underway, so that's exciting to know.
Yes, and actually, if you're not quite as interested in the London Olympics, there's also the Edo Olympics going on, which, crazily enough, the Deltons keep winning them every year. I mean, what are they doing in there?
I know. They are really good in that. I hear the only human ever to medal in the Edo Olympics is William T. Riker.
He does. He's pretty impressive. Right. Let's just put it that way. He's an athlete.
Right. You need a lot of endurance to medal in the Edo Olympics. And so Riker's in there. All right. Well, coming back over to the other side of the pond, as they say, it's just a few weeks until Star Trek Las Vegas kicks off.
Yeah, and people are getting jazzed for this. And I'm really sad I'm missing it this year. I'm already laying in plans, setting a course, Warp 8, for Star Trek Las Vegas next year. So right now I'm just sort of doing the pre-planning. And it's good to see, finally they've released the schedule. So we can actually see what you can do, when, who's going to be talking. This is looking like a really, really fun year in Las Vegas.
It is. There is so much stuff going on. So August 9th through 12th at the Rio, and those days are just packed. They have the whole schedule up at the Creation Entertainment website. So you can go to creationent.com. That'll get you over there. If you want to go straight to it, we'll put the URL on the show page because it's kind of long and has a bunch of weird characters in it. But creationent.com, and then click through the Star Trek Las Vegas area and you can get the whole schedule. But some of the highlights. Now, on Thursday, they're going to kick everything off with what sounds like a very interesting session, although it sounds like it was named by Microsoft because it's a it's an incredibly unique opportunity called Coffee with Show Business Icons Nichelle Nichols and Ben Vereen. So it's not exactly the catchiest name. It's a little bit overly descriptive,
no.
like a Windows RE for Surface Tablet operating system.
Yes. I mean,
but the event sounds really interesting. I think it would be a lot of fun to sit down and listen to Nichelle for a while.
Yeah, I mean, Coffee with Nichelle Nichols would be just really fun. She seems like she's a genuine soul and just one of those people that is great to have in the convention circuit. I, of course, haven't seen her, but these are the reports I hear that she's just a wonderful presence. And I don't know quite the show business icons bit of it I don't quite understand what they're coming at it from, but I this is definitely be something I'd like to be a part of.
Yeah, she really is. I mean, you've seen interviews with her, I'm sure, where she's talking about science education, talk about NASA, so forth.
Right.
And even after we had the earthquake last year, if you remember, she was autographing photos of her as Uhura and donating all of that money to the recovery efforts as well. So yeah, she's a great person. So that's coming up on Thursday at 10:45. Mm-hmm. They do say it requires a separate admission. Now, I don't know if that applies to people who have the big packages or not, you know, like the top level packages,
right.
but possibly.
Yeah, that's always confusing, but I'm sure if you have a package, you know what you're able to get into and what you have to buy a separate ticket to, hopefully.
So also on Thursday, they have a lot of different people taking the stage throughout the day from the various series. And also they're going to be having this two-man theatrical event with Ethan Phillips and Renee Abergenoy. And also Jeffrey Combs and Casey Biggs and Armin Shimerman are going to be performing Shakespeare.
Yeah, and I hear Jeffrey Combs will be playing at least five different roles from Shakespeare.
I'm sure he will.
Over the course of that.
Especially...
That would be fun. I mean, this seems just a chance to let these actors do whatever they want. And if they want to do Shakespeare on stage at Star Trek Las Vegas, go for it.
Exactly. You know, and they're going to be doing the truly authentic version of Macbeth, which is rarely performed these days. The one that involves Shran.
Right.
Oh, so that's going on.
Ah, Shran, I knew thee well.
That's going on Thursday. Also on Thursday, friend of the show Larry Nemechek is going to be in the Voodoo Lounge having a party. And there's
a trivia contest.
So, exactly, yes.
So bring your Star Trek encyclopedia.
That's right. Bring your iPhone with memory alpha.
That's what I mean.
That way you'll have Larry's whole book right there in your hand. So anything he asks you...
Along with all the audio commentaries.
Exactly. You'll be all
anything
set.
Larry has ever said out loud...
That's right.
basically transcribed for you, so...
Oh, goodness. But that'll be going on. That would be a lot of fun, no doubt. So head over there, Voodoo Lounge at the Rio for that. What else do we have coming up? On Friday, there are breakfast events. There's going to be a panel called Trek Girls, which sounds like something that... you would be very interested in attending, Greg.
Probably. I believe this is Ashley Eckstein, who I believe is behind those Star Trek for girl shirt, like girl shirts for girls, something like that.
Her universe line.
So that would be a fun panel to see.
Yes, definitely.
Trek Girls. There's also Friday morning breakfast. Mm-hmm. So if you've ever wanted to have breakfast with Connor Trinneer, Dominic Keating, Garrett Wong, Patty Yasutake, Hallie Todd, and Alexander Engberg, this is your chance.
Well, you can go and you can have your breakfast with Patty and you can talk about all those missed opportunities to write Nurse Ogawa off the show, Greg.
No, I don't want to write Nurse Ogawa. I was fascinated by her arc. No, I was actually fascinated by the fact that I had no idea she existed until this rewatch. Because she was just always there in the background until I started watching the episodes one after another, and I realized that was the same nurse every time.
Yes, Greg, I'm also fascinated by the fact that you had no idea that Nurse Ogawa was a thing, as you put it.
I thought there were only seven characters. How am I supposed to know that?
There are seven characters.
It's like the people on Lost. You know, you got like the blue striped shirt girl who just walks in the background holding logs. Like, you don't think of her as a main character. It's only the people who talk. So I assumed that the nurse was just one of the log-carrying people.
All right. Yeah, you never know she's a character until she suddenly gets her own episode.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let's see. What's happening on Saturday? There's a writer's workshop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like. And Ronald D. Moore is going to be on stage. So if I was there, I could finally ask him the question that's been hounding me for years, which is, why didn't they go with the original ending to Generations? Which I think I'm the only person who even thinks about that, or definitely I'm the only person who actually liked the original ending.
Well, I know you're the only person who sends me iMessages about that topic, so that's something I know for sure. Oh, so that's going on. Of course, the big TNG reunion is going to be taking place on Saturday, which will be very exciting. There's going to be a Ferengi get-together with Armin Shimerman, Max Grodinchik, and Aaron Eisenberg.
I wonder how much you have to pay them to hop around like monkeys.
I am so looking forward to getting to The Last Outpost on my Blu-ray. I just think that...
It's beautiful. It's amazing, the restoration they've done. It's worth looking at, if not worth seeing.
Well, I just think that those furs and whips are going to look amazing in high def. So,
they do.
You know,
I'm
trying to make my own fur and whip set. So when I finally do make it to Las Vegas, I can wear that around for the whole weekend. And I want to make sure it's very authentic. And so I've been waiting for the Blu-ray to come out.
You can look at the details. You know, they were so close. Like, they weren't that far off from it being fine. It's really the one shot where the portal is talking to Riker, and the Ferengi are like jumping around behind them and just like poking into frame. He's lying to you. And it's just that one shot just really completely ruins them.
You know the shot where the three Ferengi are there, and they're like three of them posing together, and they're like hissing. About two seasons ago, I believe it is, on Sports Illustrated. It was before the college football season. They had the national championship contenders. It was Alabama. They did it for regional covers. So they had like Alabama. I think they had Texas doing it. Maybe they had USC. Mm-hmm. I don't know who it was. But the Alabama one, our three players looked just like that pose from The Last Outpost.
Wow.
I was like, man, Sports Illustrated, art director, this is really bad. And I guess they thought it looked really cool. But as a Star Trek fan, the second I saw it, I grabbed the image off the internet. I grabbed the still shot from The Last Outpost. I put them together and I tweeted it out. And I said, you know, I think I've seen this shot before. All they needed was some fur on their uniforms, and it would have been perfect.
Yeah, I didn't know they were allowing laser whips in the NCAA.
No, it's usually against the rules, but they're kind of changing it to make the game more exciting.
Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely. So I completely understand.
All right. So that's going on Saturday. And then on Sunday, George Takei will be there. Oh, my.
Yeah. Have breakfast with George Takei and Walter Koenig. That would be quite a breakfast. We skipped over. I did want to mention on Saturday, there is going to be a Voyager gathering. So
that's right.
Those of you who are my age who really grew up with Voyager, they've got pretty much the whole cast, I mean, including Robert Beltran. So maybe he'll actually punch Garrett Wong there live on stage.
This is my question, okay, with this panel. You have Kate Mulgrew, Robert Beltran, Roxanne Dawson, Tim Russ, Robert Duncan McNeil, and Garrett Wong. Now, usually you don't get all these people together on stage at once because Robert Beltran doesn't do cons very often. Now, we all know that Robert Beltran is rather disgruntled about his time on Voyager. And we all know that Garrett Wong takes every possible opportunity to talk badly about his time on the set of Voyager. So I'm curious to know if having Kate and Roxanne and Tim and Robbie there, is that going to kind of keep the focus more on the good aspects of the show? Or is having Garrett Wong and Robert Beltran together on the stage at one time, is it going to become kind of a like, these are all the bad things they wouldn't let us do on the set of Voyager kind of panel?
Yeah, I'm basically expecting to be getting some of the reports out of the con about things said out of order to some extent. Yeah, because they just it's really hard for them to not make comments like that. But we'll see. I mean, maybe they will. Maybe Robert Beltran will have turned over a new leaf, and we'll be talking about all the times he enjoyed being second in command to Janeway and not getting to do anything whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I take Robert Beltran's comments a bit more seriously than I do Garrett Wong's, because I can see how he would be really disappointed in what he was expecting the character of Chakotay to be and how the character of Chakotay actually evolved through the series.
Right.
So I put a little bit more stock in his experience that he had, you know, what he says about his experience. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that I absolutely, I understand where he's coming from. It's still, I mean, it's just disappointing because you see Jonathan Frakes out there who obviously loved his time on Star Trek and is just having fun continuously. And it doesn't seem like Robert Beltran ever accepted his role right. as much as Frakes did.
Well, look at the difference. I mean, Chakotay never got to spend time on the bridge with the Trill Ensign, but Riker did. So
that's true. That's true. Maybe if they let Robert Beltran direct one or two of the movies, he'd be talking a different tune.
Oh, yeah, probably so. All right. Well, that's some of what's happening. Again, that panel is on Saturday. Then on Sunday, we have the breakfasts, as we mentioned. There's the four captains live on stage. Shatner, Mulgrew, Brooks, Bacula are all going to be there.
Right. I guess Patrick Stewart's going to be, you know, in his lounge with Data watching the Olympics. So
probably.
Couldn't be there.
Yeah, that may be it. There's going to be a before and after behind the scenes look at the TNG remastered project, which would be great. So it's just so much stuff. There's just no way that we can even start to scratch the surface of what's happening in our rundown here. But we wanted to give everyone kind of an idea of what's going on. If you just go over, as we mentioned, creationent.com or look on the show page for this show, which will be trek.fm/TRR59, we'll have a link there and you can get the whole rundown. So happening not too far away, a little bit before the Las Vegas Con starts on August 3rd at Dodger Stadium, is a really unique event, Greg. This is Los Angeles Dodgers presents their first ever Star Trek night at Dodger Stadium.
Yeah, and I saw this and I was like, wow, that's really quite cool. It's coming up this week, and I guess it's in celebration of the TNG Blu-ray. So it's a cross promotion with CBS. And I'm not entirely sure what all it entails making it Star Trek Day. I mean, will they be playing with the, you know, the new rules that were that were around when Buck Bakai is a player?
Yeah, I hope so. Maybe they're going to be playing against the London Kings.
Right, that's right. And I understand they figured out the whole, you know, infield fly rule. All of that's been taken care of by then. So they're just going to go ahead and skip forward.
Well, I think there are a few things here. There are those rule changes. There is, of course, the very important rule change that in order to score when you come across home plate, sliding into home plate or simply crossing home plate is not enough. On Star Trek night at Dodger Stadium, you must do a barrel roll into home plate.
Do a barrel roll. The barrel roll.
Nice.
Otherwise, you don't get the run.
Right. Absolutely. And I understand at the end of the game, after everyone's, you know, fought and there's been runs scored and you've made great, you know, progression, they just hit a big reset button and everything goes back to how it was
exactly.
before.
Exactly. Everyone's record just goes right back to what it was before.
Yeah.
Now, one interesting Star Trek rule that they did put in for this game is that in the event that the game is tied after 9 innings, there are no extra innings. Instead, everyone gathers in the outfield for an Ambo Jutsu match.
Nice. Oh, and instead of dugouts, they have staff meetings.
That's exactly right. Especially the seventh inning stretch where they have the extended staff meeting. A real highlight. That's when you can go to the pavilion and you can buy your Dodger dogs, your nachos, your popcorn. Mm-hmm. I guess one thing that's unique to it is they say they're going to have an all-you-can-eat pavilion, which is probably unique because, as far as I know, in Major League Baseball stadiums, the concessions tend to be very, very expensive. So an all-you-can-eat pavilion would be quite a bonus, actually, kind of a special night.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And the other thing is, if you're one of the first, you know, however many attendees, you're going to get a special Spock shirt that has the LA Dodgers logo and has Spock. And for some reason, the number 12, which I've been trying to figure out how 12 is related to Star Trek or Spock. I don't know. It should be a 47, but what can you do?
Oh, it's totally.
And the other thing is that the other thing is that William Shatner will actually be there to throw out the first pitch.
Excellent.
Well, I'm not making that up. That's actually, he will be there.
I know. Oh, I don't know what the number 12 means, unless it's 2012. That's all I can think of.
Ah, okay, 2012, but that's, it's, okay.
I don't know.
I guess that's it.
Was there a famous baseball player in Major League history named Spock that wore the number 12? I don't know.
Probably.
Maybe one of our listeners who is a really big Major League Baseball fan understands what the connection is. Maybe it does have something to do with MLB history, and maybe they can let us know.
Maybe.
So tickets are going to be $33 each, and that's going to include the all-you-can-eat pavilion. You don't eat the pavilion, you eat the stuff that's there, along with the limited edition Dodger Star Trek themed t-shirt that we were just talking about. So you can figure that out. You can call 866-DODGERS, right, or you can visit losangeles.dodgers.mlb.com and find your way to the tickets, or go to the show page and we'll put the really long link and you can hop over.
I thought you were going to read out the whole link and I was just waiting for that to happen. What would be really great is if we have William Shatner reading a URL, you know, losangeles.dodgers.mlb.com. Yeah.
They should do that. Do you remember when he used to go on the Conan O'Brien show and read Sarah Palin's tweets?
Yes, yes.
That was pure gold.
Oh, he's always... So. He's always hilarious. I saw him on Craig Ferguson, and he's just fantastic.
He is awesome.
He'll also be reading. He'll be there reading the lineup of the game. So you know, in first base will be. I don't know any Dodger players, but it. I wish I were in LA because this would be the one Dodger. I don't care about the Dodgers at all. I don't even know who they're playing, but I would definitely go here. And if I had a Starfleet uniform, I would wear it. It'd be interesting to see how many attendees are going to be wearing their uniforms and what uniform they choose.
It will be very interesting because you have to balance wanting to really get into the Star Trek theme for the night with not wanting to get beaten up in the parking lot by the regular sports fans who are there who think that right. We are all Uber geeks.
Yeah, I've been... I won't mention what events I've been to, but so far the two... theme days that I've been to for baseball games have been things I've not been interested in whatsoever. And I was just sitting there rolling my eyes for every time they'd stop the game to have some, and now we're going to do a tribute. And like, not do we really have to? So I'm sure they're gonna play, you know, the bum, 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 bum. And you're just going to have all these Dodger fans just rolling their eyes. Nerds.
Oh, I'm sure this game will be on television. Maybe I can find it on online.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be fun to see.
That'd be a reason for me to keep my MLB.TV app at least through the game so I can see what little bits of Star Trek they pepper in.
Yeah, definitely. All right, Greg. Well, moving into movie news and rumors, everyone's favorite new rumor monger on the block, Carl Urban, apparently has something else to say, but he's not at liberty to discuss it at this time. Apparently, however, crew is going to be tested in the sequel.
Yeah. Carl Urban is on the block and off the reservation. That's his new album coming out next year.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, he says they're all getting tested, which I'm assuming doesn't have to do with their upcoming trip to Ryza.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking, too. It's like, how often does Riker get tested?
Yeah.
Beverly's like...
Hopefully multiple times per episode.
You come down to sick bay, it's time for your weekly test again.
But I think he means mentally and physically and all of those things where... Cannonbatch and whoever he's playing in the movie will be really driving them to have to, you know, understand themselves better and, you know, get through it. They were tested, though. I mean, I think in the first film, in Space Adventure 2009, I think people were pretty much tested. There were some hurdles to overcome.
There definitely were. I mean, Kirk had to hide under the bed when Uhura came into her quarters. Mm-hmm. That was...
Yeah.
Now, he failed that test because he got caught, but that was a test. It was one of Kirk's first tests of having to hide in quarters like that.
Yeah, and Spock was practicing his crouching while transporting maneuver, which I think he did a pretty good job of that one.
He's quite good at the crouching while transporting.
Chekhov actually won an award for best use of Russian during a Star Trek film, which we haven't seen much of.
Right. I think he is the first ever winner of that award, in fact. Because
could you translate that, Chris? What did he say? I can't even pronounce it.
I'd have to go back and watch the movie again, to be honest.
I think it was translated. I saw it in Japan. I saw the film in Japan first. I think it was translated just "Sugoi," which I found hilarious.
Probably. Yeah, I love it in the Japanese subtitles when something comes up in English and they're like not quite sure how to translate it because it's very colloquial or something, and they'll just put like "Wow" at the bottom in Japanese or "Is that right?" or something like that.
So, you know, just in general, you know, kawaii ne.
That's right.
That's, you know.
It's so cute the way Chekhov runs through the corridors of the ship. Yes, Chekhov was also, I mean, his athleticism was really tested as he had to run through the quarters in order to go down and practice the video game with Scotty.
Yes, exactly.
The
that's testing. And Scotty had to hold his breath as he was going through the tube in the beer factory.
Exactly. So there were so many tests in that movie. Absolutely. Now, Carl Urban says here that I think that everybody's character gets to continue to develop and you learn more about them and what makes them tick. And they get tested like they've never been tested before. Now, when you've only done one movie, to say that they get tested like they've never been tested before, basically, you know, the bar is not very high yet.
Right. That's true. I mean, maybe he's including the comics. That could be. And you got to figure they all went through Starfleet Academy, went through the trials. You know, everyone had to do that, you know, faked engineering accident, you know, that they put Wesley through. There's tests. There's tests along the way. He's making it sound like there's something really dramatic that's going to come. Something apparently more dramatic than Vulcan exploding. I don't know.
I don't know what's more dramatic than that, but we'll find out when the time comes. So that's all he can tell us right now, because again, as we know, Carl Urban is not allowed off the reservation.
Yes.
All right. But apparently Bruce Greenwood can talk a little bit. So Bruce Greenwood is filling us in on some of the sets and talks about the secrecy.
They seem to have told all the actors, just don't talk, don't say anything at all. Because they're really trying to hold it in. Of course, what's going to happen is in the last 4 months, everything is going to come out about the movie. And, you know, a week before it comes out, the novelization is going to be released, which is going to have every detail and more. So I'm not entirely sure why they bother to this extent. But Greenwood did say some interesting stuff. One thing is that they're using green screens as little as possible, which probably doesn't mean they're not putting special effects in like every shot. It just means that they built as much as possible and tried to make it immersive for the actors. And so if they're putting in special effects, they're not relying on just huge green screen backdrops. They're just going to put things in and figure out where they go.
Yeah.
Which does make a big difference for the actors.
Yeah, it does. And I'm glad that they're going for the realism as much as possible. I always prefer movies. You know, it's one problem I have with Star Wars, especially the Star Wars prequels. I mean, the originals, not but the prequels, where it got to the point where they were just one step away from Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow. Is that the name?
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Everything was shot on green screen for Sky Captain. Yeah. And I don't think it was as much a problem that Lucas used it too much. Honestly, if you look at it, a lot of it was sets, a lot of it was models. But they released way too many like behind-the-scenes pictures that were just an actor on a gigantic green screen.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at stuff for The Dark Knight, you know, they used green screens on that film. But you're not going to see a set picture of Christian Bale in front of a green screen. And because you don't want to go in with the expectation that everything's going to be green screened. And then of course, they did have scenes like they filmed the factory chase in episode 2 all just on green screens mm-hmm. and just put everything around it. And it's just like, George, come on. That's not the way you want to do it. But of course, you know, the technology's gotten to the point where they could just make the Enterprise in the computer. They could just have a really detailed computer model and have the actors walk onto a green stage and just fill in everything around them. It's within our grasp at this point. So it's good to see him recognizing that even though that would allow a little bit more leeway, they could keep making changes up to the last minute. Building sets is a good idea.
Well, it is. I mean, I think the actors need that interaction with the environment to really give a good performance. It's why so much of the dialogue in Star Wars is really stilted and it just comes off flat. And you feel like the characters actually don't understand the story that they're telling themselves because they...
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, they're just standing in front of a green screen.
And we know JJ's a really visceral film director. I mean, he's there batting the film cartridge to give it just the right amount of shake. Mm-hmm. He's literally holding the flashlight that contains the lens flare.
And as,
so, you know, that...
As we explained in a recent Ready Room, he's also holding up the iPads that he's wiggling the back of the iPad to get the lighting right. So,
just perfect.
Well, I'm glad they're going for the realism. You know, they haven't really let this fact get out too much because they do want to keep things secret, but that was an actual volcano they were lowering Zachary Quinto into in those previous shots.
Yes,
so that's the extent that they will go to for realism in this film.
Right. Now, I don't think we have to fear that there won't be some amazing special effects. We already know that ILM's been working on the effects even before filming started. So there will be some amazing special effects in this film. It's going to be a visual feast, an extravaganza. But they're also trying to keep it as grounded as possible, make sure the actors are giving that performance, because we need that. If you don't have the big three giving a intense personal performance, then we're not going to ever believe that they're being tested. We're just going to believe that they're walking through green screens without a care in the world.
Exactly. If Chekhov, Sulu, and Uhura aren't performing, I'm disappointed.
The big three.
That's 5-Year Missions, Return of the Archons, leading us into our discussion of one of the most iconic episodes of the original series. As part of the development of the Abramsverse, IDW has been reimagining classic episodes, and the most recent 2-part release put a new spin on Landru. Today we're going to talk about both the original TV episode and the IDW comic version, and we'll do it in separate parts, so if you aren't interested in the comic and you have the enhanced podcast from iTunes, you can just skip over that chapter. Now, to help us discuss Return of the Archons, we have with us David Taylor. Hello, David.
Hello.
And also we have our TOS editor, Drew Stewart, who has vanished off camera. Drew, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right.
My laptop is not what it once was.
Ah.
You're talking about your computer, right?
Yes.
Oh, well, welcome both of you. Welcome, Drew and David.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, welcome, guys. So we're going to talk first about the episode, Return of the Archons. We get a lot of things here. We get the TOS take on the Prime Directive. We get Kirk's solution to the problems of alien worlds. And also, we get the Red Hour.
So the Red Hour. And of course, they arrive on the planet just in time for the Red Hour.
Exactly.
What it's a like coincidence. They were waiting for Kirk to arrive.
Maybe what that's it? What spawned it.
They landed, what, about like 5:42? Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much.
What a coincidence. So, speaking of the Red Hour, now we were just having this discussion on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
How often does the Red Hour happen? I always felt that it was a daily thing, but they don't really specify.
I always thought it was daily, too. It seemed exhausting.
I never got that impression. I always assumed it was like an annual thing.
Well, didn't somebody come up to him and say, you know, are you here for the festival or are you here?
Yeah. Right. Which kind of, to me, makes it seem like they're not, it's not an everyday occurrence. Like, ooh, guests, they must be here for the festival that we don't have every day. And when would they sleep if every night from 6 to 6?
Like I said, I thought it was exhausting.
But see,
but fun.
It's really hard to tell. You know, I actually went over and I checked, like, what does Memory Alpha have as a definition? And all they say is, the Red Hour marked the beginning of the festival on Beta 3 during the governance of Landru. It started at 6 o'clock in the afternoon. But just because the Red Hour starts and this other person asks, are you here for festival? It doesn't necessarily mean that the two are connected either. You know, the Red Hour could happen all the time, whereas the festival could be an annual event and it just kind of happens.
It could be different things.
That also implies that it's only there.
Well, they say that in the dialogue. They talk about how maybe they have different ways in the valley, and the three elders have the whole big debate about whether Landru's will is universal or whether it's different at different parts of Beta 3.
Which makes you think it's a much bigger society than we've seen.
Well, I hope so. That, I mean, if it's just this one
town. Part of the problem. Right, that's part of the problem with the episode is that it's all set in, you know, the old town set on the Paramount backlot. And as David and I were discussing in the car earlier, they're wearing uniforms that they just, or, you know, costumes that they pulled out of the, you know, off the rack. Just, oh, this one fits Shatner, this one fits D.
Exactly.
Well, let's see what we got here.
Yeah. So we only see a small portion of the society. We don't see the whole grand world. We just see a little bit of it.
Which the fashion reminds me, I want to organize a flash mob. I want to get 300 people dressed like Sulu at the beginning of Return of the Archons. And I want to go hit a Best Buy or something.
That'd be pretty awesome. Can I go up and shout, festival, festival?
Yes.
As long as I get to jump through the window at the front of the building.
I love that guy. Like, why do you jump through rocks. A window?
You got to figure if they're doing Red Hour every single day. I mean, they got to replacing the glass sheets every time.
Exactly. They have redo all the windows.
Maybe they go ahead and install.
Landru takes care of it overnight.
Oh, that could be. Yeah.
In the morning.
It's true. If he can pull a ship down from orbit, he can reinstall the sugar glass.
That's true.
Yeah.
And replace the foam rocks.
Right.
Man, so many people get hit right in the head with those and don't react at all.
I don't think I ever noticed that until watching this episode. One of the, I don't know who it was, but they're running and a guy gets hit directly on the head and it bounces off. Perfect.
It's one of those things.
It's almost like somebody was trying.
Well, you've got the interns off camera throwing the foam rocks, so...
They're the same interns that threw the giant foam spears in the Galileo 7.
Yes, exactly.
Right off camera.
Yeah.
So the red.
What do you think? What do you think is the origin of the Red Hour? I mean, I've heard theories that it's like because they have repressed emotions. This is them allowing it out. So it's sort of the Beta 3 Pon Farr.
Well, it is the Pon-far. Now, you do know that in Vulcan, Pon means red and Far means hour, right?
Is that right?
Fascinating. I did not know that.
Did you just arch your eyebrow, David?
Probably.
Fascinating.
I'm going to have to write a non-canon novel about that.
What do you think is the origin of the red hour?
That seems pretty good. It reminds me of going to the Star Trek convention in Vegas. You know, I've got all this Trekkie energy pent up inside me, and then I can finally let it go.
Is that what Star Trek Las Vegas is like? I think I'm starting to understand the appeal then.
I see. Greg is now ordering his tickets.
So random women like jump on you and start making out with you like they do to Kirk?
They do.
Greg, come back. You can order your tickets after the show.
Greg, no, I must order
move away
them now.
From the laptop.
I'm here for the red hour.
Yeah, Greg walks into the bar. Greg walks into the lobby of the Rio and yells, "I'm here for the red hour, baby!"
Everybody would go crazy.
But imagine festival, but instead of a bunch of old west dresses and stuff, everybody's you got the Trill Ensign, you've got Ferengi, you've got Vulcans, and everybody's there for the red hour.
It would be intense.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
That's a fest.
I just hope a lot of people come as Edo and Deltons.
Edo? Judge Edo?
No, not Judge Edo.
Sorry, I'm alienating half the audience now.
The Edo from Justice, from the Next Generation. Yes. On the Love Planet. Where...
Right.
They all run around naked and they kill people if they step on flowers, but...
Is that the one where Wesley falls into the flower bed?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Falls in the flower bed and gets... He almost gets written off the show, but unfortunately, not quite.
But the episode would have been so much better if everyone on the planet had looked like Judge Ito. And
right.
So what you're saying basically is the origin is that on Beta 3, long ago, maybe 5,000-6,000 years ago, they used to have these Landru conventions, and everyone went
That's
crazy
exactly what I'm saying.
At the Landru convention. And then eventually, as Landru became just a computer, the people continued to go wild from 6 to 6.
Exactly. They were conditioned.
Hey, am I the only one who thought that the zombiness of the Beta 3 ends? Threesians? Anyway. It was a little overdone. Like, they were just sort of shuffling along. Like, it didn't quite sell to me as a perfect society.
Well, I think that's what... That was Kirk's point, was that it wasn't... Even though the computer insisted it was a perfect society, it obviously wasn't. There was something weird and zombie-like about it because they had no personalities or anything like that. My question is, why do the old people... Why are they normal?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like, once you get past a certain age, Landru's just like, you've been conditioned enough. We won't worry about you, and you don't have to let out your emotions during the festival or whatever.
Well, obviously, I mean, you wouldn't want them involved in festival because he wants a bunch of old people. But yeah, I don't understand why they're free of the zombiness for the rest of the time. You'd think they just continue to be zombies during festival.
I don't know. And it's not clear that all the old people on the planet are immune to this. We just happen to encounter these three people in this hotel.
Right. The resistance.
Yeah. who resist.
I was thinking that. I kept thinking of Battlestar Galactica.
So say we all.
And the episode's Resistance and Occupation. They're setting up like car bombs and stuff to try to fight back against Landru.
Well, they have a community, for sure. Mm-hmm. But how on earth could you fake it?
Right, right.
Because like you said, everybody, I mean, it was over the top. I mean, McCoy, when he got zapped, he was, it's pretty clear that you're abnormal, if you can't just stand in the corner talking to your friends.
Yeah.
Without getting called out.
Now, do you think Gene Roddenberry was making a comment on religion here?
Of course.
Because that really comes across to me, because I've had some cases where a friend of mine gets indoctrinated in some sort of, not even necessarily a cult, but just when you first join it and you're just like, oh, have you read this book? Haven't you? Don't you understand? Are you of the body? And it really felt like this was Gene Roddenberry saying, yeah, and this is what it's like when you take that to an extreme.
Well, yeah. Agreed. And it is what it's like if you take it to an extreme.
I don't want to touch that.
Not to get too controversial about religion here, because obviously we have listeners of all different beliefs in all different countries everywhere. But there is in anything, I mean, whether it's religion, organized religion, whether it's other beliefs, I mean, there's always anything that's taken to an extreme can have this potential to become dangerous, to where if you never question authority, you never have free thought. That's yeah. the danger, you know, of things like that. And yeah, I do think that is very much what is happening here, where these people have come to not only do they not question the word of Landru, but they're fearful to even think that they might question. Even the people who are the resistance movement will immediately back down if they think that Landru is there, or those yeah. giant Jawa guys are going to come get them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, do you think they have like legitimate thoughts going on in their head? Because they, I mean, there are still those, you know, staff guys. I don't even know what to call them. The monks with staves, the lawgivers.
I call them giant Jawas. Still,
the giant Jawas. They still have yeah. the giant Jawas around. And so those guys must be used for something. So are people, yourself, is it self-imposed zombiness? And maybe that's why it's gone to such an extreme, because people have been zombies, and then their kids were zombies, and then their kids were zombies. And eventually people have just forgotten how to be normal people.
Maybe that's why it seems so exaggerated, their lack of emotion. It may be they are exaggerating it for, you know, so they don't get in trouble. Maybe it's not necessarily a brainwashing thing so much as a fear of the lawgivers.
I had always kind of imagined that they were more like the Borg, where you had Landru controlling everything. Everybody had their part. Everybody did their thing. And like we just talked about, the festival was everybody got to do what they wanted to do. And it just, you know, everybody went crazy because, you know, they had their freedom for a little while.
That's an interesting point, because Greg sent me a message. We were watching this the other day, and he mentioned that this is like the origin of the Borg. And
it felt like that in places.
I mean, obviously we don't mean literally like the actual Borg originated on Beta 3 or anything, but it is interesting as a concept that the way that they're coming at them in the alley, it's very much the way that Borg drones would come at you on the ship. And what I found even more interesting is that when the resistance leaders were taking Kirk and the crew trying to cross the town, and they're saying, oh, we don't have much time. And then everyone kind of activates, and everyone picks up rocks or sticks, and they start to come at them. And that is the case, yes, where Landru had activated a collective to attack a threat, which is exactly how the Borg would operate.
That's very true.
Yeah. I'd not thought about it like that.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. And I don't know quite where to go with that. Obviously, they're not the actual origin of the Borg, but it's an interesting way to look at the episode. Because they can get switched on, get switched off.
Was Roddenberry involved with the Borg? Was he around when he was
around? Yeah,
yeah.
I don't know how much hands-on he had to do with actually creating them, though.
Yeah, I think by the time of Q Who, he'd stepped back a little bit.
So this seems like a theme that he's dealt with a lot, though. You know. Losing yourself. What was the episode with the spores? Paradise.
The Side of Paradise.
The Side of Paradise.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty similar. Maybe not really.
Well, there's a lot of mind control. There are a lot of plots in which something controls the minds of the crew, whether it's a computer, whether it's some kind of, spore or some other virus or... And that happens not only in TOS, but, you know, TNG and throughout. But it does happen kind of often in TOS where there is some kind of mind control.
Be interesting to go ahead and talk about the sci-fi tropes, especially the Star Trek tropes that exist here. I mean, here we have a society that's functioning. I mean, most people are pretty happy. And Kirk comes in and says, no, this isn't right. And he fixes it for him. Yeah.
Yeah.
which at least this is a case of things were pretty messed up. I mean, it's hard to look at this society. I mean, if you look at okay, I was talking to Chris, at least, about justice and how the Edo society is pretty messed up, too. I mean, they're under a strict totalitarian regime, but at least they're happy. At least, you know, you can look at them and think, okay, they're having sex a lot. They're probably doing fine. But you look at these people, so, and it's hard to think that they're just let them go along their merry way.
So your definition of the perfect society is you would be fine with any kind of totalitarian controls put on you as long as you had sex a lot. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that sounds pretty
fair. That's pretty much what I said, yeah.
Cool, yeah. I'll second that. Is there alcohol too?
Well, now it brings up my favorite line actually from Landru here is when he explains to them the reason for the control, and he says that there's no war, no hunger, no disease, no fashion sense.
Wait a minute.
So he solved all the problems that the world had.
As a computer would.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was the problem.
Yeah. But being serious about it, they say in the episode that it goes back about 6,000 years. The world was destroying itself. Landru was the leader. He managed to prevent the world from destroying itself. But in order to do that, clearly, very strict policies had to be put into place. The government took a lot of control over the lives of the people. Now, what I gather from the ending is that perhaps the original Landru had some compassion for people, and maybe he wasn't as authoritarian as the computer is. But of course, the computer is strictly interpreting the will of Landru or the plan.
Right.
And then it becomes purely totalitarian. But if you look at the world right now, I mean, the you see freedoms being stripped away even within the United States, which is supposed to be this great beacon of democracy around the world. And it's like you see things changing where you're not allowed to do certain things anymore that you could do in the past. You know, the government has over the past decade eavesdropped on people's private conversations more. Mm-hmm. You feel like there are more controls coming into place. So I guess
You just have to look at like an airport security line, and there's a bunch of shuffling zombies waiting to be told what to do next.
Well, I don't know if I would describe everyone as all the people in the line as shuffling zombies.
They're supposed to be, at least.
But yeah, well, that's the thing. That's what I think that the TSA would prefer if everyone behaved that way. But of course, the people don't want to behave that way. But
right.
I mean, is there a danger that like we're in the infancy of something like this, that it can snowball to the fact that we have a society that becomes something like what they're warning us about in this episode?
Yeah, I think so. This episode's probably, I mean, we're talking, this is the 60s and, you know, everybody's afraid of, you know, the bomb. Everybody's got the bomb, man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what Roddenberry, or maybe they're trying to show, you know, look, a society without these things, violence and stuff, they're what makes us human.
Yeah.
And maybe this is a cautionary tale. I mean, it was true in the 60s, and I think it's still true today. I mean, the world may be a scary place, but, you know, there are scarier alternatives.
Well, and it's an interesting thing that part of what Roddenberry did, write the story to this episode and give it to someone else to actually write the teleplay. But a lot of what Roddenberry seems to want to talk about in the original series and even in Next Gen some is the right way to do utopia. Because he is showing Starfleet as being, and the Federation as being, a utopia. You know, there is no famine, there's no disease, they have weather-controlling satellites and no money. But he wants to say that we've retained, you know, we've retained creativity and art and the things that still make us human. So here's bad thing, bad thing, bad thing. These are bad ways to go about getting utopia. And that's really fascinating. One thing that I find weird about that is this prime directive that they put up, because it always seems like they're coming across a bad utopia, but the prime directive is keeping them from really doing anything about it. Whereas when, if it's so important to Roddenberry that we have the right kind of utopia, shouldn't Federation be going in and trying to explain to people, you know, don't go down this path. This is bad. Don't listen to a computer. What do you guys think of that?
It's a really fascinating thought. The idea that I hear what you're saying. I've never really thought of it that way. It always made sense to me that you'd never mess with the culture that was developing. But to what you said, if you do, if you have the benefit of all this knowledge and years of evolution, and you see people going down a path that you know is going to be horrifying for them, it's, you know, you'd be morally obligated to help them, you know, push them in the right direction.
And, I mean, you don't want to go down the, you know, they will greet us as liberators route. I mean, obviously there's, that's another cautionary tale to be had.
Are they allowed to go down and dressed up as, you know, in the garb of the day? Are you allowed to go down and kind of push people in the right direction and maybe take out somebody that...
I think that would be frowned on.
Kill the Edo Hitler.
Exactly.
Well, a lot of this is about freedom. You know, Kirk tells the Resistance guys, which are Reger and Marpline, I think, which sound like rats from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or something. But but he tells them that it's time you learned that freedom is never a gift. It has to be earned. So it is a cautionary tale about freedoms. And if you talk about the Prime Directive, it's really tricky. It's like you want to say that you shouldn't mess with other cultures as they're developing. You want that to be a cautionary tale on Earth, that you don't want one country going into another country and engaging in nation building just to impose their views of how the world should be on another culture, because cultures have developed on Earth for thousands of years independently. So naturally, we all see the world differently. So what works for one culture may not work for another culture. So you can't assume that what you know is definitely better for the other people. So that's,
but Kirk certainly makes a, you know, 10-minute judgment call.
Well, Kirk does. Yes.
This society that I've seen all of, you know, five people in obviously is not not progressing. I mean, he doesn't know what's. I mean, maybe in the valley there's a bunch of people who are, you know, doing modern art.
Well, and they're dependent on these people under the world for their supply.
Right. Like we don't like, he really doesn't know. So is Roddenberry, it seems like he's endorsing what Kirk's doing here.
Well, do you think it's safe to say that Starfleet represents America in that time period?
Yeah.
You know, we're free. We know what we're doing. We can come in and tell you what to do, but we shouldn't, unless we think you're wrong.
Well, yeah,
right. I see.
Do you think that's, I always kind of viewed Starfleet as a what Roddenberry and Hollywood would, you know, consider to be an ideal view of America and America's values.
Yeah. So it's knowing when to drop a logic bomb and when just to sit back and take Wesley away.
Right.
I'm sorry, I keep finding parallels to this episode in Justice, okay. Which is probably the first time in history that's ever been done.
Probably. So, but my point was that with the Prime Directive, that on the one hand, you want to talk about if there's a society that's being oppressed, you want these people to have their freedom. At the same time, you need to let other societies have the freedom to develop on their own course as well. So it's really like a catch-22. You know, you can't really have it both ways. And so I think here you get the message too, where, well, there's the Prime Directive. We can't mess with the society. Oh, wait, we don't like the society, so maybe we can mess with it. And then at the end, as Kirk often does, like you said, Greg, he makes this very quick judgment. And at the end of this episode, spoiler alert, he blows up the computer. And then he turns to the natives and says, well, you've got your freedom now. I hope you're up to it. And he says, like, you're on your own, I think, actually.
He says something just like that.
You're on your own. I hope you're up to it.
You'd expect to see a big banner above the square that just says mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished. Right above the computer. Yeah. But it's like, I actually laughed. I mean, again, I've seen this episode countless times, but when I was watching it again before the show, I actually laughed this time when Kirk said that, because I was just imagining if like someone comes down to Earth and they like destroy whatever's holding our society together. Yeah. And then they just say, well, you're on your own now. I hope you're up to it. And they fly away.
Yeah. Like they come, they blow up Washington, D.C. and they're like, we did good.
And then they fly away.
In Kirk's defense, later on the ship, they had sent one person down to help them rebuild, right?
He does. I think they actually mentioned that there are going to be teams going. So they do mention that afterwards when they're back on the ship, which was good because they don't always do that.
We can't just leave them like that.
Well, right. They're like, wait a minute.
Well, he does it to everybody else. In the Apple, he blows up that big, the big dinosaur computer.
He blows up the computers in A Taste of Armageddon so that these planets will have to actually use real weapons against each other.
Well, what about the time where he goes in? These poor women, they were running their planet off this one guy's brain, and he just takes their computer's brain and says, psh, and runs off with it.
Well, brain? What is brain?
In his defense there, they did steal his friend's brain. So he was just taking back what was rightfully his in the first place.
And also, to be fair, in all these episodes where he does destroy an entire culture, they do tend to do something to members of his crew first.
Right.
Well,
like Sulu and McCoy are brainwashed, and that other guy, O'Neill.
Yeah, but you got the prime directive. You're supposed to die before you'll interfere.
I do love how nebulous they leave the prime directive. I mean, this is the first time we learn about the prime directive, and they really don't sit us down and say, this is what it is and this is what it means. And that continues through Next Gen. I don't even think it's till Voyager that they really start nailing down what the prime directive means. The one thing we do get is that Kirk says we will let developing nations continue.
Well, I don't know.
Next Gen, there's something about warp power. Like they have to be capable of warp power before
we
contact
them. Well, that's a detail. I mean, I think in Next Generation, it's pretty clear that the prime directive is non-interference in other cultures. I mean, you have the episode First Contact where Picard really explains to them that, you know, our rules don't allow us to do this. But then they do tackle
unless
that.
Unless you're sleeping with space, Lilith. But that's
right. Then it's okay. Yeah. But then they add in that element of they have to be warp capable. Well, if you're warp capable, then we can mess with you all we want to.
Right.
And then
be able to fight back.
Right, and that's the thing. Like, where does the prime directive, I guess to your point, where does the prime directive fight against, you know, self-defense? Like, we do have to get Sulu and McCoy and whatever that other guy's name was. We have to get them back, and you know, we're not going to let the prime directive get in the way of our crew members surviving.
Right, and that's a big change. Once you get to Voyager, the prime directive means you can interfere with other cultures unless that interference would allow you to get home, in which case you then cannot interfere, because anything that might allow you to get home, you must avoid at all costs. So they can screw with your crew members all they want to. If they have technology that would allow you to get home more quickly, you cannot interfere.
Right.
That is the prime directive.
I feel like by the time of Voyager, the prime directive had been completely played out. I'm actually enjoying Deep Space Nine. I don't think they ever mention the prime directive. And if they do, it's like, because they're dealing with known societies and known cultures, and it's such a relief.
Yeah, they don't deal with a lot of unknowns there. So,
yeah.
Because it's prime directive episodes. Yeah, I love that.
Oh, man.
It challenges the way I think.
It challenges the way Janeway thinks, too. Some episodes she'll be like, we must uphold the prime directive at all costs. And other times, everybody's like, we need to break the prime directive. And she says, I'm not looking.
Now, I like the prime directive in principle, but it's hard to write because you can't stick to it rigidly and actually tell the kind of stories that you need to tell for the drama of the show. So it comes off as being a very wishy-washy thing that was frequently disregarded And it brings up the question too. I mean, if you can see that a society is destroying itself, do you just stand by and watch it happen just for the sake of this principle of not interfering, or do you step in? And I mean, that's a difficult question to answer.
What's the episode where they're accused of doing that, of allowing societies to crumble because of the Prime Directive? I'm forgetting. It's something I watched recently. And they just say, yeah, we do that. Like, sometimes society falls apart and we don't do anything about it because we're from Starfleet. And that's a really hard...
And the idea of a culture crumbling might be a part of its greatness, right? You know, 500 years in the future. Right.
Yeah, I mean, how many cultures crumbled on Earth before today? And, you know, as with Starfleet history, we're going to crumble again before we can, you know, come out of the ashes, just to continue with the whole Phoenix thing, and the Vulcans can come. Like, our society has to crumble over and over again. So I guess that's part of what Kirk's doing here. Kirk's getting them to the next stage of their evolution, at least, because they'd sort of hit a point where nothing else was going to happen.
I think that's fair.
So I think Kirk in this case is justified. We can look at some of the other episodes and see exactly what we think. But in this one, yeah, I do think this society was going nowhere. So no one needs to feel guilty.
Didn't they even mention that? That it's only for a society that's progressing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Kirk says. I think he just wrote that in the margins of the Prime Directive. But
I guess in this situation, too, where they felt that humanity was somehow intertwined with this because of the Archon having been lost. I guess in the episode, we don't delve very much into that. We just kind of have this mysterious, are you Archons? And they don't really get into the connection. Now, in a minute, when we talk about the comics actually really plays up this angle of Starfleet and the Archon and what's happening on this world. So
this episode actually feels like a whole bunch of things are really underdeveloped. Like, what is the Red Hour? Who are the Archons? What's going on in the rest, like on the rest of the planet? So I want to hold off on the comic discussion. But yeah, when you're watching this episode, it's just this one little town. And it's just where we're like, are there really only three people that are unaffected by the will of Landru in the entire planet?
Yeah, and you don't know.
I mean, they do mention something about it being a network, and each group only has three members. So you'd assume that this, at least this underground network, does have more than the three of them. But yeah, you never get an idea of like how big the society is, or the culture, the planet.
Yeah, we do know there are more than just those three guys, but we really don't know how many there are, and we don't know if they're all old or not. So it would be interesting if maybe we can go find some non-canon novels that explain that. But
I'm sure there is one. Yeah.
Well, there has to be. There's just too much stuff here to continue the development of. Before we get to the comic, I know you did want to talk about DeForest Kelly's performance in this episode.
Yeah, well, we talked about it a little bit, but Sulu, the same thing, George Takei, when they do the whole zombie thing, they don't just become zombies. It's really an interesting transition. Where they just have this like, I have the will of Landru. I'm of the body now. Wouldn't you like to be of the body? Exactly, David. David's making some sort of gesture, but it's this side of D for McCoy that we never really see. And it's really fun to see them playing off character from time to time.
Yeah. It's like he's not curmudgeonly old doctor. He's, you know, nice. He's nice, friendly, smiley, creepily smiley.
Just an old country doctor.
That's right. Although no one can get as creepy as the first guy that comes up to them on the street at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, that guy still creeps me out.
It's very creepy.
He freaked me out as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
He is so, I mean, even for those people, he's creepy. You know, I mean,
that's right.
The other people are just walking around. He's just over the
top. Joy to you, friends.
What's up with that? Miss Derby? Was everybody wearing hats or just, I mean, and he had too much makeup on. It was weird.
Oh, man.
It was very, very weird. All right. Well, why don't we transition into the comic discussion a little bit. So if you've not read the comic, if you're planning to read the comic and you don't want to be spoiled, then you can skip over this part. If you have the enhanced podcast in iTunes, there will be chapters. You can just skip over this to the next chapter. And or if you're not planning to read the comic, then I encourage you to listen on, because it actually is quite interesting, the take that they have gone with here, different take on Return of the Archon. So,
yeah.
So, Greg, why don't you kick us off with comics?
Well, I'd say the biggest difference is, I mean, as always with the comics, they're upping the production value, because all you have to do is draw it. But see, they made a big change by making it medieval society rather than, you know, whatever's on the Paramount backlot and whatever they can find in the trailer for them to wear. So it is, it feels a lot more like a, like the Middle Ages, like this idea of a continued Dark Ages. And that I think that metaphor works really well, because when you watch the episode as aired, it doesn't feel so much like a stagnant society. It feels like, you know, they're on the cusp of the Industrial Revolution. Whereas this feels like, yeah, they could just continue, you know, making clay and throwing together, you know, if you're wearing a vest and, you know, a top hat, maybe there's a little bit more to your culture. But if you're just wearing a brown robe, yeah, that's something that needs to get fixed.
would you guys say that this is the furthest deviated plot of the comics so far?
Definitely.
Yeah, certainly.
I think they really started to deviate in Operation Annihilate, and then this one is definitely the biggest deviation from the original, where they're reimagining a story. Of course, they had Vulcan's Vengeance in the middle, which was a completely new story. But
yeah, but I mean, yeah, I mean, right from the start, it's pretty different. I mean, they kind of start doing the same thing. Sulu's, you know, being chased down, and then, you know, Kirk and them beam down as well, and they find out about, well, they don't even find out about the Red Hour. Like, that's where it changes, right? Someone walks up to them and starts talking to them, but then immediately the lawgivers are upon them.
I think it's interesting that I mean, one of the first differences I noticed was, you know, they of course punch the lawgivers in the face, because it's the new universe. And they take their sticks, and Spock's like, you know, I've never seen technology like this. When in the other one, in the episode, they're like, it's just a metal stick.
Yeah, it's very specifically.
Tube. It's a hollow tube, he says, yes.
The guy from Home Depot.
But in here, Spock says, a puzzling weapon. It appears significantly more advanced than its environment. But in the episode, it's just a hollow tube.
Yeah. With magic.
Could I go back to the very first page in this comic?
Yeah, I want
to
do that.
There's something on here that really tweaks me out.
See, for the audience at home, you can't tell that everyone else is looking at their iPads. I'm not, because I don't have one. But David actually has these physical beings. Man.
Physical paper. What is that? Ink.
Let me just open up my comic book.
Yeah, what's a page? You mean?
So there's a scene where Sulu is standing in front of several people at Starfleet. And one of the things that they say is, and I'll read it, unfortunately, peacekeeping and humanitarian are pleasant words for often unpleasant realities. Starfleet has had to adjust to this truth. And they're trying to enlist Sulu in some, you know, black ops kind of thing, which to me goes against Starfleet completely.
Yeah.
And it really freaks me out that they're changing. And I know this is just a comic book, but I mean.
But I'm not sure. I'm not sure they're changing, because it sounds like they are trying to recruit him into Section 31.
Right.
And we don't know how far back Section 31 goes. So Section 31...
They're putting the DS9 Dark and Gritty into the TOS.
So, I mean, Section 31 is something that comes out of the Dominion War, right? Or is it the changing threat?
Doesn't it even go back? I mean, there's the Next Generation episode where, for some reason, Beverly and Worf. They go, you know, they're on the black, they're going on this covert mission. Now, they never mention Section 31, but right. in retrospect, I almost feel like that was some yeah. Section 31 related mission.
Yeah. Right. But yeah, so what we basically get is that there's this sort of Black Ops side of Star Trek.
Not in my Starfleet.
And I mean, there's the same scene actually that's in this comic. I think in Enterprise, right? Where they're trying to recruit.
Well, they try to recruit
Reed
Malcolm
into
yeah.
it. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, this is that weird thing where there's, and it's anti Roddenberry. And that's why it's mm-hmm. so weird to see it here, because it's so different. It's something that would never, ever be in the original series.
Oh,
it's
sure.
part of what happened to Star Trek, you know, later on.
Yeah. It's a creation that came along. Around the time of DS9, which played a big role on DS9, and then Enterprise, in retrospect, had them go back and try to recruit Malcolm in the 22nd century into Section 31.
I would say at least, I would not include that scene from Enterprise in my own personal canon. And the way I'd like to look at this scene is that this is an effect of Nira's incursion and the heightened threat. I mean, the fleet got blown up at Vulcan. Vulcan got blown up. Starfleet's in a pretty bad position, similar to where they were during the Dominion War. So yeah. the idea of Section 31 starting here makes more sense than it being around in the Enterprise era.
Now here's where your theory and everything else falls apart, is that the comic... This is where you're wrong.
Okay.
The comic... it turns out that Landru was a Starfleet scientist trying to create the perfect society
right.
on Starfleet's orders, and that they were actually watching the society and are mad that Pike let Kirk run in and destroy all their pretty business, which means that Starfleet was doing this kind of crap before Nero incurred. I think that this isn't just that JJ's universe isn't just an alternate timeline. I think it's an alternate universe, like
right.
the mirror universe or something. There's no real starting point. It's so totally different. Like the Archon that they
yeah.
show in the comic has the ample nacelles of
yep.
of the JJ verse.
Yeah, I think that's true. That Nero didn't just enter our universe and create a split. He just entered. I mean, we've seen this before, right? What was the episode where there was the darker, not yesterday's Enterprise, but there was like a darker version of the next gen crew. It wasn't quite a mirror episode, but there's these other realities. And so the idea here would be that Nero entered another reality that had already been changed. And I guess I don't have a big problem with that. And that actually probably helps explain a few of the more things that how could Nero have actually affected that? The idea being, there's a split off point way before, or there's no split point and it's just a parallel universe.
Right.
Now you all know that JJ's movie is just a reboot, right?
No, it's a prequel. It's a prequel sequel reboot.
This is why this is so much fun.
Right.
You get to rebuild it.
What's interesting is that the Abramsverse was presented as if the timeline had been moving forward, and then after the point of Nero's incursion
yeah.
created a split in the timeline. And Zachary Quinto's Spock in the movie actually says that whatever our paths would have been, they have changed. So he implies
yeah.
that everything was exactly the same
yeah,
up until Nero came in and then everything split. Well, he is the voice box for the writers. So this is what
right.
their thought process was. And this is what was presented to us.
Yeah.
But now...
Or this is how we'll explain this.
Right. Well, exactly.
Right. To people like us.
Right, right. But now, Drew, you brought up a really good point when you sent me a tweet about this, that this does imply that the timeline was different before Nero's incursion,
yeah.
which would imply that this is an alternate universe, not an alternate timeline that has branched off.
So do you think it's Orci rethinking it? Do you think they're sort of coming out from a different direction than they did when writing the movie back in '07?
You want to know my honest answer?
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's sloppiness by the writers, because remember, this is the same comic series where in Operation Annihilate, Kirk tried to beam up to the ship by tapping his comm badge.
Yes.
I did notice that.
It's also the same...
Seriously?
Yeah.
Yes. It's also the same series that in Vulcan's Vengeance, they were having a covert meeting in a bar in the Delta Quadrant, which was run by Tellarites and Andorians. Yes. So yeah. I think there's some sloppiness in the details here, and this stuff kind of crops in. And yeah. I think that...
I would be really surprised if anything in any of the new movies reference anything in the comics.
Well, they say that the comics are tying into the sequel. That's what they have said.
I've heard a lot of stuff. I've lived for years with George Lucas telling us that he would put all kinds of stuff in the prequels that he didn't end up doing. Yeah. So.
Well, I don't mean that they're going to like actually lift things out of the comics and put them in. And like you said, they may not actually reference it, but all of this stuff, because it's being overseen by Orsi and Bad Robot, it's supposed to be leading up to the movie. It's supposed to be, and Orsi actually said last week or the week before in an interview that the comics are canon. He considers them canon. So
I think he's just saying that so that I'll want to buy it. I mean, because that's the only reason I'm reading these things is because he's just like, look, these are canon. Look, this will tie into the movie. I honestly believe it's a bunch of hooey, but...
Yeah, if this is canon, there's some huge... I have some huge problems with this.
Well, so that would be my question for you guys, and I guess I'll point this at David. What do you think of the... canon or not, alternate timeline, what do you think of the idea of this being the origin of Landru and this being the story of Return of the Archons? Because it's not the episode at all.
It's not anything like the episode, yeah.
Well, they really fleshed it out. I kind of like the idea that Landru, you know, they gave us who he was and what he did, being kind of sinister and taking over. I don't know. It changes it so much in my mind. I have a little trouble just buying into it completely because it's so different. Yeah, I don't like that, I guess. I'm having trouble with it. If this is the new canon.
Right.
Because as vague as they had been in the original series, I think I'd already kind of fleshed it out in my mind. And this really goes against that. I like the idea of Landru being a little more mysterious.
Yeah. When you were saying something about plot holes to me in the car earlier, as we were inhabiting the same meat space, which is a crazy thing for Twitter friends to do.
So in the comic, Landru, the computer system is, you know, they stumble upon it and are immediately awestruck by what it is and that, you know, my gosh, this is Landru. And throughout the entire comic book previously, there was no real encounter with Landru other than, you know, these people. I mean, he was hardly even mentioned other than I guess O'Neill was absorbed, had his mind wiped.
Well, yeah. And they definitely never show the like apparition of Landru that shows up a bunch of times
with the cool hair.
He was awesome.
And the cool outfit. He did rock his hair, didn't he? In the TV episode. Yeah. Well, I think it will be interesting to see where they go with this because they are setting up Starfleet to be this maybe, I don't want to say
darker.
Darker, but I guess darker is the right word. But, it's more like you would expect from an organization like Starfleet, just like you would any government on Earth right now, that there's kind of all this stuff that goes on behind the scenes and they're not quite as... upfront or out for your benefits as you might think they are. But that's, again, not what Starfleet was painted through the original series onwards. And so are they going to continue developing Starfleet in this way? Or is this just a one-off interesting take on a classic story, but in the next classic story that they reimagine, is Starfleet going to be back to what we're used to again?
I think it's going to be like I always come back to Voyager. I think it's going to be depending on who's writing it, on who's going to be the good guy, who's going to be the bad guy. you know, what people's motivations are going to be. I think that because we're not getting weekly episodes anymore, and we're just going to get these big movies, the movies aren't going to touch on things like this, unless this is the plot, you know, that Starfleet's doing something dark and evil behind the scenes, and only the Enterprise is, you know, now fighting other Federation ships in order to, you know, free society from the evil that they've brought themselves. But
Drew, have you been avoiding the spoilers for the new movie? Don't you realize that Cumberbatch is playing Landru in the new film? I mean, Trek movie announced that weeks ago.
Right. They even had shots of his hair.
That's awesome. I cannot wait for that. How is he still alive, though?
Landrubach. He's zombie Landru, of course.
Oh.
He's been resurrected. Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm excited.
Oh, God.
I can't wait for the first trailer that, like, is just clips from the comic book. So that people will understand.
Star Trek Red Hour.
Well, let me bring up something else here related to this. Now, I think that, first of all, Drew, I think what you said is probably pretty accurate. Like, you compared it to Voyager, right? Where it depends on who's writing it, because Voyager was an incredibly inconsistent series in terms of the writing. And even the personalities of Janeway, for example, is very inconsistent. But if they go down this darker path here with the comics, I think that this is not what the majority of Star Trek fans want to see the Federation like. And of course, if it's only in the comics, I think it's not a big deal because not that many fans read the comics in the first place.
Right.
A lot of people read them, but it's nothing like the people who watch the movies or the TV shows. And thus, what concerns me is there's all this talk about the possibility of a TV series, probably animated, which would be overseen by Orci and the Bad Robot team, most likely. If they're going in this direction in the comics, might they go this direction in a TV series and then lead the franchise on a weekly basis in a direction that's not what the fans want to see? Is that a concern to you?
It's definitely a concern, especially after this issue. I mean, I love the up production values. I love the vision of the Archon as sort of being a JJ-verse Enterprise era ship.
The Archon looks amazing in here.
It's really cool. Yeah. I don't even mind the idea of like an evil scientist an evil Starfleet scientist, because I mean, that's a trope we've seen in Star Trek plenty. It's when we start getting into that Starfleet was behind it.
Right.
That's where I don't quite like it. And again, it's also making the world smaller. Return of the Archons wasn't about a Starfleet colony. It was about a culture that was developing on its own in deep space. You know, it doesn't say, you know, these are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise to seek out deep space colonies. You know, it's to seek out new life. That's what we want to see. We want to see them boldly going to new places, not going where they went a century ago.
And it's about improving the human condition, too, and improving society. Mm-hmm. That's what Star Trek's always been about. So if it just turns into a situation where, as much as I love, say, Deep Space Nine or Battlestar Galactica, you know, very, very interesting shows.
So say we all.
They both do diverge from that vision of a better future and an improvement of society. And that's what I think has made Star Trek so endearing to so many fans for so many years. So I do hope that they don't go down that path with this new
take. Are you saying that we as Star Trek fans have come full circle? That we used to make fun of TOS and TNG for being so idealistic, and now that we've seen the dark and gritty for so long with DS9 and Battlestar, that maybe we're missing it, especially since they're trying to like put that into TOS, which we all love.
Yeah, I think you're hitting on something there, that it's seeing it stuck onto a TOS story is a huge shock to the system. It's which I guess it sort of that's the same way my parents have this reaction to the updated Battlestar, because like that's not Starbuck and Apollo. They're not supposed to be, you know, running around like and you know, doing dark and gritty things. They're supposed to be having fun and it's supposed to be goofy. And I'm having that reaction here where I'm saying, no, Kirk's supposed to be fixing a society that's gone awry. It's supposed to be a big morality tale. It's not supposed to be about Starfleet going off the rails. It's not supposed to be a dark and gritty future.
Could it be that we're missing the point because it's just two issues of a comic book? I mean,
they
right. simplified the story a lot. Maybe they simplified it and weren't able to put the emphasis on the right part of the story because they had to limit it to so few panels.
Yeah, totally. That's why I'm wondering where it might be headed from here, because definitely in these two issues, they can't really delve into it. So is it a one-off and are they going to drop it?
Yeah.
Or are we going to head down this path?
I mean, maybe it's not so much that this issue, these issues are horrible. It's the trajectory I'm seeing. From Operation Annihilate through to this, they're making bigger and bigger changes. They're making it more about, let's really upset the core of Star Trek. And, you know, I don't want to see, you know, where the Doomsday Machine was a Starfleet experiment from the 22nd century. That's just, that's not Star Trek. That's not what I'm interested in seeing.
And it's not that these issues are horrible at all. I mean, actually, this particular comic, I think, is a really good comic, Return of the Archons, as a comic. I don't think it's a question of, for me anyway, if these comics or these issues are horrible. I think they're good, but it's a question of, are they good Star Trek or not? Or are they just an interesting story?
And it's interesting that, I mean, we are the core fans, and we are the people reading these comics, and the whole thing with Star Trek, this new Star Trek Space Adventure 09, whatever you want to call it,
space movie 2009,
is that it was supposed to bring new people in, but still those new people, my mom is not going to read she's not a new fan.
Your mom doesn't read IDW comics?
Right.
Really?
Well,
God.
You're right. The people that jumped on board to Star Trek because of the JJ film, no, they're not going to read this. This is something else. This is something weird and different. And I think I'm with Chris that I think they're good issues. I enjoyed reading them. But I don't know really who they're for, because they're not for the core Star Trek fan. They're not for the JJ fan. So I'm not quite sure what space they're occupying.
Maybe they're for comic fans.
It could be.
I've never really read comics before.
If you just take them as comics, just standalone comics. Yeah. All right. Well, we've been through. Of course, we don't want to give away every detail in the comic because we gave you enough that you know it's a very different story.
Because we already did.
We gave you enough that you know it's a very different kind of story and give you some details, but believe me, there's plenty more in these if you go read them that we didn't reveal. So they are very interesting. Before we completely wrap up here, why don't we go back and just give our final thoughts on the episode so we can bring everyone who skipped the comic segment back in here for the end of the show. So going back to the original episode itself, what do you have as any final thoughts on that story? Because it is one of the great classic and kind of iconic stories of TOS.
Yeah, and somehow it's one of the great classics that I don't return to. I watch over and over again Space Seed, Where No Man's Gone Before, Ultimate Computer. There's like a list of like six or seven episodes I'll watch over and over again. Somehow I've skipped this one for most of the time. So I don't think I've even watched this episode in a few years.
Is it because the guy creeps you out too much? Because I know that you had nightmares about schisms. So I think things just creep you out too much and you just can't return to them.
That could be. Maybe I have some repressed memories from childhood. Watching it, I do think it deserves to be in that staple of episodes that I go back to. It's got the morality tale. It's got that, should we follow the Prime Directive or should we fix the society? It's got great performances from Shatner and Dee and Leonard Nimoy. So, no, I enjoyed watching it. I probably enjoyed the episode more than I enjoyed reading the comic. Definitely enjoyed it more than A lot of these other episodes I've been watching here or there, it's no Spock's brain. Even well, though it is one of those
what can
go
be.
To a culture and find out what's wrong.
Can be.
Yeah, few can aspire to that, but... Well, how about you, David?
I really like Return to the Archons. It's one of the episodes that I do go back to often. The idea that... Well, it's one of the episodes that Captain Kirk talks a computer to death. So that's going for it. And what Greg said, it's a morality tale. I love thinking things through like that where, you know, is it the right thing to do? You've got the prime directive. And I mean, I'm really drawn to Landru for some reason, the idea that you have a society that's almost on autopilot. And I really like it. It's one that really gets me thinking.
How about you, Drew?
While it is one of those episodes that has everything, when I was looking at the schedule for the IDW comics and they were like, we're going to do Return of the Archons, I was like, really? Archons? It never really stuck with me. I mean, and it's a first season episode, so it means I just watched it. And I'm just like, that's the one with the lawgivers and Turk. I mean, I guess he talks a computer to death. I assume that the climax of the comic was going to be the new Kirk punching the computer in the face somehow. You know, just to give it a, you know, the finger. But the episode's pretty good. I don't care for the costumes and the backlot right. set and stuff like that. That really brings it down for me. But, I mean, as a plot, I mean, I like the episode. It's good enough, but I do end up skipping it when I'm thinking of classic episodes of the series.
Yeah, the costumes and the set definitely leave a lot to be desired, but that's classic TOS. I mean, that's what they had to work with then. And it's actually one of the things that I do like about TOS. TOS was my first series. It's what I watched as a kid, and it's what got me into Star Trek. And as I've said many times on the show, you know, what I love about Star Trek most and what Star Trek means to me is it is that exploration of the human condition and talking about social issues in a way that we sometimes can't do straight on. So we have to do it through science fiction. And this one is very much that classic original series morality play, again, like you said, Greg. And there's just a lot of really great dialogue in here. For all the talk of how Captain Kirk, you know, sleeps with the women or punches the aliens, or Shatner really delivers a lot of really important lines throughout the original series, a lot of commentary on society, and it's right here in Return of the Archons. So this is, I would say it is probably also an episode that I don't watch as often as I watch some of the other ones, but it is what I consider one of the iconic episodes of the original series and one of the top stories if you want to know what the original series is about. So it's high up on my list as well.
Solid warp factor 6.5.
Yeah, it's a good 6.5.
I'll give it a 7.25.
I love how we've suddenly started giving ratings on this show. We did 57 shows with no ratings, and then last show we suddenly are giving ratings. But
it's like on Whose Line Is It Anyway? The ratings don't matter.
That's right. The ratings
they don't really
matter.
Mean anything.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us, guys. David, tell everyone where they can find you around the internets.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Sci-Fi Commons, and you can find me on Facebook at Sci-Fi Commons also.
With an at sign?
No.
Oh, okay.
Drew, tell everyone where they can find you.
Well, they can find me on Twitter at 005, DOUBLEOFIVE. They can also find me and Greg under TOS_season4.
Yes.
Where we tweet unfortunate rejected plots from the fourth season of Star Trek.
I think Kirk may be talking some more computers to death this week.
Oh, that's That's one of the tropes that I've got listed on the site of things I want to touch on frequently is killing computers by talking to them. Dropping the logic bomb. We still need some kind of trope name that we can give
That's true.
Do you think it pisses Spock off when Kirk's talking a robot to death and Spock's just standing there? Seems like it should be his job.
That's true.
I don't know. But at the end of this episode, Kirk tells Spock that you would make an excellent computer. So if that's true, that it could be actually giving Spock a migraine during that time.
That's true. He's saying like, stop
it's not
it.
Enough to kill him, but... And of course, everyone, you can find Drew on Trek FM as well, writing about TOS as our TOS editor. And Drew, you have two episode guides up right now, the Corbomite Maneuver and A Mock Time.
I'm excited that they're finally up. I was reading over them again as we were editing them, and I'm pretty proud of them. So you should go read them.
Go read them. It's the Wheel of Landru. All right. Thanks again, guys. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys. Well, I always have fun talking about the original series. It's not the series that I go back and watch most often, I suppose, especially given my current next-gen Deep Space Nine marathons. So it's fun to see, this is how Star Trek started. This is what people thought of as Star Trek for decades.
Oh, yeah. For me, for a long time, that was Star Trek. I was in high school when The Next Generation came about. And so my vision of Star Trek now, you know, has grown and expanded. But things like Return of the Archons, that was Star Trek for me for so long. So I'm glad we got to talk about it. I always do enjoy when we get back around to TOS every 5 or 6 weeks on the show here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think it was a good discussion. So if anyone would like to share their thoughts on Return of the Archons, on the IDW comics, on anything else we talked about today, you can just go over to trek.fm/contact and you can send us a message that way. Of course, you can go to the show page, which will be trek.fm/TRR59 for this. And we do use Discuss. So down in the comments section, you can make your comments there and you'll get notifications if anyone responds to you and so on. Of course, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM and on Twitter at username TrekFM. And Greg, everyone can find you on Twitter as well.
That's right. I am on Twitter at Greg Harbin. That's Greg. H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N, where you can enjoy my first ever rewatch of... Wait, Chris, should I mention the name of the show?
Oh, go ahead. It's fine.
It can't
be canceled.
I want to disavow...
It can't be canceled at this point.
It can't be canceled, no. Right? I mean, it's the
this
BBC.
This show is cancellation proof, so you're safe.
I must be. Okay. I'm watching Doctor Who for the first time ever. Well, okay. I made it through maybe the first 5 minutes of Rose... once and didn't keep going. But now, thanks to Playing Doctors, which is the podcast from friend of the show, Ben McCormick and Jenny Zell, I'm diving in full sonic screwdriver, whatever the term would be. And I'm actually enjoying it. I'm liking the show. I'm figuring out that it's not Battlestar Galactica. So say we all. It's not Star Trek. It's something different. And that's okay. So you can follow along with me as I'm watching the show.
I haven't listened to the show yet. I'm planning to, but I'm going to go and watch the episodes and kind of follow along with them.
Yeah.
So since I haven't heard the show yet, my question is, Greg, do they release the additional audio from the other side of the TARDIS?
I hope they do eventually, because I'm sure those are some fantastic discussions. I'm actually looking forward to being on the show, to hearing... actually being a guest on the show, to hearing what those alternate Doctor Who discussions are, knowing what we sometimes get to on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Yeah, I think it would be very interesting. All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones, and that's Brian with a Y. And I'm tweeting a bit about Star Trek, Japan design and the wedding party that we apparently crashed last night. So never know quite what is going to come out there. Oh, and a salty watermelon Pepsi as well, which wasn't very good, I have to say.
I can't imagine salt. I've heard of people putting salt on watermelon. Right. Like, that's all right. But then putting that with Pepsi, I don't see the connection. It's like the cucumber Pepsi.
The cucumber Pepsi was very good, actually. Did you have the cucumber Pepsi?
I couldn't ever bring myself to actually try it.
It's too bad. That was actually one of the best ones. So for those who don't know, which is probably most everyone listening, in Japan, every summer, we get a special seasonal Pepsi flavor. And the one for this summer is salty watermelon. And I have to try them every time they come out. I will only be having this one once. Anyway, well, let me remind everyone to go to our website, trek.fm, where you can find, of course, this show, all the show notes from what we talked about. You can find our other shows, MatterStream, which I host. We have Trek News and Views with Colin. We have Deck 8 for STO players with Colin and Tom. Of course, we have Hyperchannel Video News Show hosted by Tristan. We have all kinds of stuff coming on all the time, and you can find all that over at trek.fm. Well, Greg, I'm going to head on out. It's about time for me to get ready for the red hour.
All right, Chris, I think it's time to stick a hollow metal tube in it, because the Ready Room is done.